Yes, Trey, I said, invoking my best fake sing-songy father voice. But we're only asking if you have another name in case maybe he doesn't look like a Luigi. I want Luigi! It's my favorite name, Trey wailed. Okay, okay, Jada said calmly. It's your choice. I am going to happily choke the hell out of that lady. I'm calling her now, Will. Just relax, Jada said, dialing frantically. I'm pacing around our bedroom, fuming, imagining having to introduce my new son as Luigi Smith because some damn $400 an hour shrink made up some shit about naming kids. We're going to have to move to fucking Palermo. The psychologist apologized profusely, but she had a new solution. She instructed us to quickly buy Trey a puppy. She theorized that if Luigi is Trey's favorite name, he won't want to wait until his brother is born to use it. He'll want to name the puppy Luigi, then we'll be able to ask him for another name for his brother, this time being careful to lead the witness a little more effectively. We immediately rushed out and purchased a beautiful, fluffy gray Lhasa Apso. Trey, we got another surprise for you, I said. Whoa, Trey cheered, running over to hug his new puppy. What do you want to name him? Jada stage whispers, verbally tiptoeing back into the Afro-Italian minefield. And sure enough, Trey yells, Luigi! Jada had successfully completed phase one. Now I was up. But wait, Trey. Your brother can't have the same name as the puppy, I said. Jada snaps around on me, uncomfortable with the open-endedness of my promptings. I want to name the puppy Luigi, Trey said emphatically. Phase two, nailed. Now for the third and most critical phase. So you'll have to pick another name for your brother, I said. I have an idea. We'll all pick a name. I'll pick one. Jada will pick one, and you'll pick one, and we'll give your brother all three names. Trey had just made a new friend at school named Christopher. So by the grace of a benevolent creator, Trey yells out, Christopher! I want to name my new brother Christopher! Yes! Jada shouts, damn near fist pumping. In the end, I picked Jaden, Trey picked Christopher, and Jada picked Sire. Jaden Christopher Sire Smith. For the historical record, JL refused to call Jaden anything but Luigi until Jaden's 15th birthday. Willow's birth had tipped the scales of our precariously balanced blended family, and suddenly, for the first time, from within and from without, there was a sense of my new family and my old family. In the press, when people would refer to Will Smith's family, they would oftentimes use pictures of only myself, Jada, Jaden, and Willow, leaving out Cherie and Trey. The media preferred the symmetry and conventionality of the nuclear grouping. As the heat of my global fame came to a boil, so did the cauldron of public scrutiny. My family's already fragile wax wings began to soften. Cherie and Trey started to retreat from the spotlight. But the spotlight was where I lived. I took their withdrawal personally. What do you mean you don't want to go to the premiere of my movie? My family has to walk the red carpet with me. That's how we eat. I want our son to have a normal life, Cherie said one day. I want him to go to school. I want him to go to church. I want him to have regular friends. That is not his life, I said. That's not your life, Will. It can absolutely be Trey's life. That's why he has a mother and a father. I don't want him bouncing around from city to city, set to set, with no stability. My son has to be with me, I said. I'm the man you had a baby with. So I'm the father that your son has. In order for me to parent, he has to have the freedom to move when I move. What about school, Will? Cherie said. Tatiana had a tutor on the set of Fresh Prince and got accepted to Harvard. Of course he needs to be educated, but school is not the only place that kids get educated. Well, I've seen you on set, Cherie said. You're not even going to be paying attention to him. He's going to be left with whatever tutor or nanny you hire. Some people do make movies in L.A., you know. Did you ever think about maybe staying in L.A. and raising your son? The emotional wall I keep crashing into while writing this book is that today I know the right answers to many of these questions. But in the confusion of yesterday, I created so many unnecessary messes. Did you ever think about maybe staying in LA and raising your son? Here's what I should have said. First of all, I love you. I realize that this is not the life either of us envisioned, but this is where we are. I know it's scary, but I am devoted to you and to Trey with all of my being for the rest of my life. Now, in order to secure resources for our family, I have to be mobile and I have to be global. But I hear you and I understand your concerns. It's scary to go against prevailing wisdom. I know that I'm asking you to come with me down an uncharted, dangerous, rocky-ass road. It's terrifying not to send your kids to traditional schools or to not know what city they're going to be in month to month. Now, I'm not saying I have all of the answers right now, but I promise you, if you ride with me and support me on this journey, I will die before I allow our family to not flourish. Now, here's what I actually said. Sure, then we'll just sell everything and live on whatever you can earn. Hey, man, if you say you heard it from me, I will deny it, Harry said under his breath. I showed the property to Jada, and she said it was too big. But I have known you my whole life, and you've only ever talked about South Fork. I found it. Harry, as head of our family real estate office, had been charged with finding my South Fork. Even as a child, he knew of my obsession with Dallas and my fantasy of having a property with a name. He had found a 256-acre ranch 45 minutes northwest of Los Angeles. Jada asked me not to show it to you, Harry said, so out of respect for her, I can't. But here's the address. It's everything you ever dreamed about. Harry's like Jagel. There's no sauce on his descriptions. If he said it was everything I'd ever dreamed about, that meant sneak away to see it today. There were five existing houses on the property. A beautiful lake, horse stables, hiking trails, extensive chaparral, flora and fauna. A gorgeous doe walked up to the front door on my first tour. I took it as a sign. I loved it. I had the perfect wife, three beautiful children, and I was the undisputed biggest movie star in the world. The final triumphant brushstroke on my lifelong dreamscape would be Her Lake, a house with a name. Jada loved horses. I was shaking with anticipation. I could see her, just like Sue Ellen, coming to breakfast on a stallion. This purchase would serve as the physical manifestation of my love for Jada. This land would nurture the seeds of our hopes and shelter our flowering aspirations. As soon as I saw the lake on the property, I knew it was for her. Her Lake. I considered the Spanish translation, Su Lago, but ultimately I remembered that I was from Philly and she was from Baltimore. Jada didn't want the property. All she could see were the 50 people it would take to manage, upkeep, secure, and operate 256 acres, horses, five buildings, and a bunch of bold-ass deer continually ringing your doorbell. On top of that, she knew that I would be away 6 months of the year working. saddling her with the full responsibility of her lake. She hated the whole idea. I had just visited India for the first time. Harry and I had stood in front of the Taj Mahal and marveled, not only at its aesthetic detail and beauty, but also at the loving intention behind its construction. Many people don't realize this, but the Taj Mahal is a single mausoleum designed, constructed, and maintained for one woman, Mumtaz Mahal, the favorite wife of Emperor Shah Jahan. The emperor was so distressed by the death of his beloved that he commissioned the construction of the Taj Mahal. He preserved her body for the more than 20 years it took to build, from 1632 to 1653. He spent 32 million rupees, nearly $1 billion in today's currency, and employed 20,000 of the world's greatest artisans, imported Italian marble, which was not an easy thing to do in 17th century India, and not to mention that India had its own Makrana marble he could have been using, all to create a private tomb worthy of his lost love. I related to Emperor Shah Jahan. I wanted anything I was involved with to stand the test of time. I wanted everything around me to be the grandest and most magnificent that anyone had ever seen. Powered by burning passion, my creative impulses would forge the finest expression of anything I touched. Movies, music, family, children, businesses, marriage. I was inspired and consumed by the dream of the Smith family. And her lake was an imperative. "Will, I don't like it," Jada said. "I don't want it. It's too big. It's too expensive. And you're not going to be here. It's too many people. It's too much space. It's too much noise. No." "Babe, I promise you," I said, you're not seeing what I'm seeing. You're looking at it as it is right now. You can't see what's in my head." "I don't know what you want me to say. I don't like it. I don't want it." This was Jada's second great compromise, the next stop on the ever-accelerating Will train. Hindsight, 2020. To all of my young male readers, no means no. Nothing good comes from spending your hard-earned money on a family home that your wife doesn't want. You are putting a down payment on discord, and for years, you will be paying off a mortgage of misery, or worse. One of the worst disagreements Jada and I ever had was in a therapy session around priorities. Jada and I were both given a sheet of paper and a pen, and the exercise was to list our priorities, ordered from most important to least. Jada and I feverishly scribbled away, and after a few minutes, we were instructed to hand our sheets of paper to each other. Surprisingly, we'd both only written 4 priorities. As I read Jada's, a look of confusion spread across my face. And as she read mine, her eyes swam with tears. In the 25 years we've been together, I've never felt her more injured than in that moment. Jada had listed her priorities as 1, the children. 2, Will. 3, myself. 4, extended family and friends. I had written 1, me. 2, Jada. 3, the children. 4, my career. The therapist reminded us that this was an opportunity to get to know each other better. He said that we should reserve our judgments of each other and remain open to the process of exploration and discovery. Then he asked which of us wanted to respond first. "Babe," I said, "I can see you're struggling with something. What was it that I wrote that's bothering you?" Jada could barely speak. "I cannot believe you put yourself above our children," she said, her voice quivering. What do you mean? I said, I love our children as much as you do. I was actually surprised that you put yourself third. That doesn't make any sense to me. It's like the airlines. You have to put your mask on first before attempting to assist others. Of course, I will take care of all of y'all, but by taking care of me. This explains a lot, Jada said. I feel like you're taking it wrong, babe. Oh, no. I'm taking it exactly how you wrote it on this paper. Jada, all I'm saying is that if you don't go to the gym, if you don't eat right, if you don't take your mental and emotional condition as primary, you're not going to be as good a mother. You take care of your kids by taking care of yourself. I tried to recover and clarify, but her heart was shattered. She didn't even wipe the tears. I've spoken over the years to many artists, musicians, innovators, athletes, thinkers, poets, entrepreneurs, big dreamers from all walks of life. And there's a secret conversation that always seems to arise. How can we fully pursue and realize our visions while at the same time cultivating love, a thriving family, and fulfilling relationships? And here's the harsh reality for everyone who loves a dreamer. Everything comes second to the dream. The attainment of my dream became an act of survival. In my darkest nights, my dream saved my life. It was my light, my food. My vision of brighter days sustained me. It was my whole purpose. I saw my hopes as the ticket to a better life, to joy, fulfillment, security, safety. I saw the realization of my dream as my only road to love and happiness. Failure equaled death. My belief was, when I get to the top of this mountain, I will never be scared again. I will never be sad again. I'll never be abused or disrespected or unloved. Everything worth living for is at the top of this mountain. And there is nothing I'm unwilling to leave or to lose to get there. And anyone who opposes or impedes my progress is my enemy. But here's the dichotomy. My wife was my vision. My family was my vision. My picture encompassed joy, fulfillment, and prosperity for all of us. It's my vision, but it's not selfish because I'm doing it for everyone around me. Spoiler alert. It's a little bit more complicated than a dichotomy. I never understood the term embarrassment of riches until Getting Jiggy With It went number one. It was my first number one on the Billboard Hot 100 chart. And so much shit was going absolutely perfectly in my amazing life that I was legitimately embarrassed. I always remember the image of Michael Jordan shrugging, palms up, after dropping his 6-3 in the first half of Game 1 of the 1992 Finals against the Portland Trail Blazers. He couldn't miss. He wasn't necessarily even a three-point shooter. And even though he was choosing those shots, he had practiced those shots, and he was taking those shots with every intention of making them. He was just as shocked as we were that they were all going in. Just for a sense of timeline, Independence Day was July 1996. The Men in Black song was mid-June 1997, and the movie was 2 weeks later. Big Willie Style was November 1997, right after I started filming Enemy of the State. I married Jada on December 31st, 1997. Getting Jiggy With It was released in January 1998 to a decent response. Then it labored a bit through February. That month, I received my third Grammy for Men in Black. So we were sort of okay with Jiggy not being a hit. Then the wheels of serendipity began to turn. In an episode of Seinfeld, Jerry is attempting to woo a woman who's not feeling him at all. He asks her, "What is the problem?" To which she responds, "What do you want from me, Jerry?" "I'm trying to get jiggy with you," Jerry says emphatically. Fans appreciated Seinfeld's risque redefinition of the word jiggy. That next week, Stuart Scott on ESPN, over the countdown for NBA Shots of the Week, yelled out, "And he is getting jiggy with it," over the top dunk. Immediately, we saw a spike in single and album sales, and by March, Getting Jiggy With It was number one. I was embarrassed, but I was just warming up. Oh, by the way, during this time, Jim Carrey became the first actor to earn $20 million per movie, setting the A-list fee for the top of Hollywood. So it was obvious that if Jim was worth 20, the conversation with me started at 21. Being a great father was central to my vision of the perfect life. I love the idea of teaching and crafting and molding and nurturing my children's hearts and minds. Boys need man training. It was my responsibility to teach them how to hunt, how to survive, and navigate the material world. I began to see Cherie as an impediment to my forging of Trey as a young warrior. My father raised me on the ice truck, mixing concrete at the shop. I was forged in the heat of daily battle. My son is going to be with me wherever I am, because that's the only way I can teach him, I said. Cherie and I deteriorated into almost daily parenting disagreements. She wanted me to enforce her bedtime rules for Trey, but I didn't care what time he went to sleep as long as he woke up and did his chores. He would learn about going to sleep by waking up and having shitty mornings. She wanted me to limit his video game play. But I was thinking, well, what if he's a video game genius and he's going to invent the next PlayStation? I wanted to align with his love of video games and introduce him to coders and designers and fan the flames of his excitement about video gaming. Cherie wanted me to pressure him about school and getting good grades, but I didn't view conventional schooling as mandatory for success. I was more concerned with his commitment to critical thinking. I saw school as getting in the way of me having time with him to teach him the real shit. I wanted him to see the entire world as school. Every person as a teacher, every place as a classroom. These conflicting parenting and worldviews landed us in a custody battle. Trey was about 9 years old, and now his parents were both demanding full custody. The emotion of these types of disputes is so extreme that very little sanity prevails. It becomes a strange game of chicken with the child in the middle. How aggressive are you willing to be against your ex with the risk of injuring your child if you miss? And the answer is tainted with the delusion that your behavior is strictly and only for the protection of the child. So you feel justified in higher levels of emotional violence because, after all, it's your ex's fault anyway. They are causing the whole thing. It's obvious, and everyone can see it's their fault, except them. I called Daddy-O. He listened calmly, patiently, a veteran of a very similar petty war. "Hey, man, look," Daddy-O said with an uncharacteristic delicacy. He understood where my mind was, and he knew he had to be careful. "You can't win. You can't fight with a kid's mother." The kid will hate you forever. Daddy will hit a bullseye in my heart. I knew that to be true firsthand. So what am I supposed to do? I asked. Just let her mess up my son. You have to wait. When he turns 13 years old, she ain't gonna be able to do nothing with him. And he gonna reach for you. It'll be your turn then. But for now, let her do whatever she gonna do. You just get in where you fit in. When I look back on my life, I'm still torn about the pros and cons of my decision. But I stopped fighting Cherie. I agreed to share legal custody, but Trey's primary residence would be with her. But it also meant that he could not leave the state of California without her permission, permission that she was unlikely to grant anytime during the school year. The result was 3 and 4 month stretches where I didn't see Trey. And this was pre-FaceTime. The other unintended consequence was that because Willow and Jaden were homeschooled, they were with me at all times. But true to Daddy-O's hard-earned insight, 3 weeks after Trey's 13th birthday, he asked if he could move in with me. Just as Daddy-O had said, it was my turn now. It was joyful and exciting. Jaden and Willow were ecstatic to have their big brother living with them full time. But the chasm between me and Trey was deep and wide. Dark seeds of misunderstanding, resentment, and distrust had taken root, though it would be years before their flowers would fruit. The text read, "Will, it's an emergency. Call me right now." Ellen's text was like defibrillation paddles to my chest. She lives with my mom. I called her immediately. "Yo, what happened?" I said. "Mommy was on a cruise and she was in Turkey," Ellen said hysterically. "Ellen," I said icy calm, "we're going to handle whatever it is, but I need you to take a breath so I can understand what's going on." I surprised myself with the calmness and steadiness of my reaction. I wanted to be in charge. I wanted to be responsible. I liked being the only person Ellen wanted to depend on to fix it. And for the first time, I had an inkling that I might be good at it. "Mommy was on a cruise in Turkey," Ellen wailed. "And I don't even know what happened, but she's in the hospital." "Okay, it's all good. Just relax." "Who is she with?" "Aunt Florence," Ellen said. My mom's greatest joy over the past few years had been to travel and explore. Every birthday, every Christmas, holiday, I'd surprise her and her friends with another adventure. They'd even nicknamed her the Trip Tester. In Turkey, she'd been traveling with Florence Avery, James Avery's mother. They'd become travel buddies, and James would always joke, "Your mother is dragging mine around the world on a Will Smith budget. I can't afford it. You're responsible for both of them." On the first stop of their Turkish cruise, they were walking through the ruins at Ephesus. My mom had been so excited to see the columns that she didn't notice a step that was worn away. She slipped and her ankle slammed onto the jagged concrete. My mom was rushed to the nearest hospital, which was understaffed and ill-equipped to deal with her injury. By this time, her ankle was badly swollen, and she was sent back to the ship. The ship doctor determined that the ankle was broken, and she needed to go to the American hospital in Turkey to get a cast placed properly. I was in London at the time. My mom is diabetic, and with her condition worsening and the medical barriers to travel increasing, I arranged a medevac to the UK, and within 10 days, we were back in Philly. My mom's diabetic condition caused significant complications in the healing of her ankle. It decreased blood flow, which was necessary for her ankle to heal. Her ankle had been pinned through the tibia with an external fixator or stabilizing cage, after which she had developed osteomyelitis, an infection of the bone, which, with progression, can cause a loss of bone integrity and necrosis, bone death. And while the doctors were attempting to do everything in their power to heal her ankle, for the first time, the word that all diabetics fear, amputation, was being mentioned. My mom had been in the hospital for nearly 2 months. And for a woman who had discovered the great joys of globetrotting, this immobility was becoming too much to bear. "How much longer am I going to be in this bed?" my mom said. "Well, we're trying to increase blood flow to your ankle, but it'll probably take at least 3 months to be able to determine if the procedure will be effective," the doctor said. "And in 3 months, what are the chances that you'll be able to save my leg?" my mom said. "We're looking at 50-50. "So you're saying that I could lay in this bed for the next 3 months and then you could still have to amputate my leg?" "Well, yes, that's a possibility, but cut it off now," my mom said sharply. Wait, mom, just let him finish what he's saying," I said. "I'm not wasting my life away in this bed," my mom said. "Cut it off now. I've got a cruise I'm planning on in June." That is the most gangster sentence I have ever heard. My mom's leg was amputated just below the knee. Within 7 weeks, she was fitted for her first prosthetic limb. And within 4 months, she'd set out to finish her cruise with Florence Avery. 3 days after my mom had left Turkey, a massive 7.8 magnitude earthquake hit the country, killing 20,000 people. The doctor treating her in Philadelphia told her that the hospital she'd been in Turkey had been destroyed. "All I lost was a leg," my mom said. And then she bowed her head and lowered her voice. "Thank you, God." Chapter 16. Purpose. No. Hell no. Absolutely not. No way. Never. Not gonna happen. Nope. That was my reaction when JL told me that Michael Mann wanted me to star in his forthcoming Muhammad Ali biopic. The thought of it literally ran a chill down my spine. Ali was one of the most recognized and beloved human beings on earth, a living legend. I was not about to be the dude who ruined the cinematic portrayal of his life and legacy. Besides, everything was going great. I was already the undisputed, undefeated Hollywood box office heavyweight champion of the world. Why roll the dice? Why risk my title? The degree of difficulty in portraying Ali bordered on stupidity. The risk-reward proposition was catastrophically imbalanced towards abysmal global failure and universal, eternal embarrassment. In a nutshell, I didn't like my odds. Not only would I have to learn how to fight, but I'd have to learn how to fight like the greatest fighter of all time. Great fighters can't fight like Ali. I had never boxed before. He was over 220 pounds. I barely weighed 190. The dialect and the cadence of his voice was singular. No one sounds like Ali. People throughout the world have such fond memories of this revolutionary icon of social justice. There was more video of Muhammad Ali than damn near any other person ever. And not just any old video. Classic, era-defining images seared into the hearts and minds of boxing fans and non-fans alike. Everybody knew Muhammad Ali. "Not this one, Jay. I'm not feeling it." "I think you should just meet with Michael Mann," JL said. "Look, I don't want to be in the room with him and hear him pitch for an hour and then have to tell him no. I mean, I definitely want to work with him, just not on this." "I think you should take the meeting," JL said, as if he hadn't already said it and as if I hadn't already said no. I paused and then attempted to clarify my position. No. Hell no. Absolutely not. No way. Never. Not gonna happen. Uh-uh. Nope. We hung up. And I went back to my safe, challenge-ducking, risk-averse little life. About a week later, JL called again. I would have to guess that I have spoken to James Lasseter on the telephone over the past few decades somewhere north of 20,000 times, with an average call lasting between 7 and 12 minutes, give or take, which comes out to about 171,000 minutes. This means I've spent roughly 118 days on the phone with JL. So just as a point of reference, if it were a single call and we started it by wishing each other Happy New Year, by the end of the call, I could ask him what he was doing for Easter. We've talked on the phone about everything, births, marriages, movies, kids, accidents, music, money, not money, death, dumb shit, and sports. But this 26-second call is definitely in the Lasseter top five. In his standard, unfazed, monotone flair, he said, "Muhammad Ali asked to speak to you personally." There are rare individuals among us who just know who they are. They know what they are, and they are crystal clear about what they are here to do. Gandhi, Mother Teresa, Martin Luther King Jr., Nelson Mandela, and even budding change agents like Malala and Greta Thunberg. Each accepted their divine duties and are willing to suffer for what is right and to benefit others. There is an intoxicating power in their conviction. They are calm, they are decisive, and they are loving, even in the midst of conflict and the worst of storms. Just being in their presence inspires your heart toward higher purpose. You want to follow them. You want to serve them. You want to fight alongside them. Muhammad Ali, at the height of his fame and fortune, and in the prime years of his athletic capabilities, gave up everything to oppose the war in Vietnam. He refused induction into the U.S. Army on religious grounds as a conscientious objector. And in 1967, Ali was convicted of draft evasion and sentenced to 5 years in prison. His passport was seized, he was heavily fined, and he was punished with a 3-year ban from boxing.
"I ain't draft dodging, I ain't burning no flag, I ain't running to Canada. I'm staying right here. You want to send me to jail? Fine, you go right ahead. I've been in jail for 400 years, I could be there for 4 or 5 more. But I ain't going no 10,000 miles to help murder and kill other poor people. If I want to die, I'll die right here, right now, fighting you if I want to die. You my enemy, not no Chinese, no Viet Cong, no Japanese. You my poser when I want freedom. You my poser when I want justice. You my poser when I want equality. Want me to go somewhere and fight for you? You won't even stand up for me right here in America, for my rights and my religious beliefs. You won't even stand up for me right here at home."
I meet with the champ, his wife Lonnie, and his daughters Layla and Maymay in Las Vegas. Ali is seated in front of a bowl of chicken noodle soup. Even though I had no intention of portraying him in the film, I couldn't help but clock his hair, the shape of his lips around the spoon, his left hand balancing himself on the table while eating with his right, and the surprising fluidity of his physical movements. He looks up and sees me, his face collapsing into the iconic Ali scowl, his top teeth comedically biting into his bottom lip. "Who let this sucker in here?" Ali yells as he jumps up from the table.
Clearly, the family has been here before. Everyone falls into their roles. Maymay steps in front of her father. "Come on, Daddy," she says. "Let's not do this today." Ali pretends to struggle to get past her.
"This sucker think he can just walk up in here? Let me at him," he said, sounding just like Muhammad Ali.
It's Lonnie's turn to step in. She and Maymay are now trying to both hold Ali back.
"Come on, honey," Lonnie said kindly. "Just finish your soup. Can we have one day when you're not trying to fight somebody?"
Not to be outdone, I decided to play along. "Listen to your wife, champ," I said. "Just eat your soup. You don't want none of what's over here." This puts Ali into a mock rage.
"That's it. That's it. Y'all move out the way. I want to hear how he talked with my fist in his mouth."
Everyone is roaring with laughter. Who knows how many times the family has played out this scene, but this time it was Ali's gift to me. He knew I would talk about it for the rest of my life. That's how Ali was. He was trying to create something that would make you smile forever. He knew he was Muhammad Ali. He knew what that meant to people. And there was no length he was unwilling to go in order to autograph your heart with a loving memory. Once he calmed down, he hugged me. He began checking my biceps and my abs and feeling the bone structure of my hands. He held his hands up like boxing mitts.
"Let me see your jab," said Muhammad Ali.
"Well, I haven't trained or anything yet, champ.
Come on now. You can't jab with your lips. Let me feel it," the greatest fighter of all time insisted.
I didn't know anything about how to box or land a punch. I was a southpaw at the time. But I reach out and tap Ali's hand with the saddest right-hand jab. And Ali scares the hell out of me as he screams in pain, doubles over, clutching his hand.
"Did y'all see that?" he said, pointing at me. "That boy just hit me. I was minding my own business, and he struck me. You going to jail tonight, sucker."
The room once again erupted in joyous laughter. Ali then announced to Lonnie,
"He's almost pretty enough to play me."
We talked for hours.
"They done put me on a diet," Ali said. "Lonnie think I'm getting too fat."
I peer comically at his stomach.
"Yeah, look like you got a lot going on over there, champ," I said.
Ali put two hands on his belly, looked down at it, and shakes it.
"Aw, man, this ain't nothing but a young girl's playground."
I clocked how similar our senses of humor were. Our banter was fluid and comfortable. There was a deep, childlike core to him that harmonized with my own. His heart was transparent to me. Ali told me about his childhood, how his life changed when he learned how to fight, his Olympic win, his difficulties with women, the strained relationship with his father. I was shocked by how much I innately understood him. The actor in me thought,
"Oh, shit. I might be able to do this." "I don't want anybody else to do this movie," Ali said. "I've been telling folks no for years, but I would be honored if you would tell my story to the world."
Michael Mann is one of my all-time favorite filmmakers. Heat, The Last of the Mohicans, The Insider, Manhunter, Miami Vice. The meeting was in a small warehouse that he'd converted into his office in L.A. The main section was a 3,000-square-foot Muhammad Ali war room. Thousands of pictures, books, memorabilia, magazine articles, stacks of overstuffed color-coded binders, videos on multiple televisions, interviews on one, Ali's jab on a loop on another, a heavy bag, weights, wraps, gloves, and jump ropes surrounded a perfectly lit boxing ring in the center. It looked like an FBI Quantico situation room. The level of detail was mind-boggling. When I arrive, Michael Mann is mid-conversation with an elderly Italian man. Four black leather jackets hang on mannequins in front of them.
They're in some dispute. Michael wanted an identical jacket to one he'd seen in a picture of Ali from the late 60s. The Italian man was the now 75-year-old tailor who had made the original jacket. He had sent four versions of the jacket, none of which had met Michael's approval. So Michael flew the man in from Chicago to discuss the problem. The tailor is vehemently defending the precision of his work, pointing back and forth between the 1960s picture and the jackets. All four jackets were identical to my eye, by the way. "Michael, with all due respect," the tailor says, "I made the original jacket, and I made these four replicas. Everything is sourced and constructed exactly as it was 40 years ago." "Something's off," Michael says. "It's not right." As the debate intensifies, it suddenly hits Michael. "I see the problem," Michael Eureka's, pointing at Ali's collar in the photo. "The stitching on the collar of the replicas is single thread. But look, in the photo, the stitching is double thread." The tailor squints and realizes that Michael is correct. He then remembers that in the mid-1970s, the fabric of the thread changed and he stopped using the double stitching technique. He shook Michael's hand and set off to make the jacket. Right. As it turns out, Michael Mann is a savant-level researcher. I had never before, nor since, met a more thorough cinematic scientist. We sat at Michael's desk. "I met Malcolm X in 1963, Michael said. "I'm 1 year younger than Ali, so generationally, I was pissed about a lot of the same things he was pissed off about. I'm not looking to idolize him. That would diminish his humanity. This is not a story about boxing. It's about politics, war, religion, and rebellion. I want to create an inside view, an intimate perspective. I want to see the despondency when his fortunes are at their absolute most abysmal. Look, I have no idea how to become Muhammad Ali," I admitted. "Well, fortunately, you don't have to worry about that," Michael said. "I will create the curriculum that will render you as Ali. All you have to do is follow the syllabus." Michael explained that he would do all of the research, build a world-class team of teachers, experts, trainers. He would be in charge of my schedule. He would surround me with people who had actually been there with Ali. He would pick my clothes. He would build a cast. He would even choose the music that I would listen to. All I had to do was commit. I loved the sound of that recipe. Take one firm commander, mix in some clear orders, just add discipline, and shake thoroughly. I could definitely do that. "But it's not going to be easy," Michael said. "It's going to take everything you've got, and then just a little bit more than that. Do you have any boxing experience?" "None whatsoever," I said. Michael, unfazed, maybe even a little inspired by that damning revelation, reaches for the phone on his desk. "Is Daryl still here?" he asks, knowing damn well that Daryl was still here. "Good. Have him come in." Daryl Foster is the individual hardest man I've ever met in my life. Born and raised on the streets of Washington, D.C., Daryl survived a horrific childhood marred by violence and abuse. "Shit, it's a damn miracle I ain't dead or in jail," he'd say. "If it wasn't for boxing, man, ain't no telling. These gloves saved my life." Daryl was an athletic prodigy. He started boxing at age 10, and within a few years, he was the best amateur boxer in the country at his weight class. At 13, he won the Golden Gloves, the equivalent of the Super Bowl for amateur boxers. He was undefeated. He had college scholarships lined up. His coaches were even eyeing the Olympics. Then, at 17, Daryl Foster nearly killed a guy in the ring, pounding him after the referee had told him to stop. Just like that, the sport that Darryl owed his life to was taken away from him. He was banned from competition. Darryl became a trainer. There, too, he excelled. He had grown up with Sugar Ray Leonard, one of the best boxers of all time, and had been his training partner, helping him win an Olympic gold medal and become world champion in 5 different weight classes. Once Sugar Ray retired, Darryl moved out to Hollywood and began consulting on films. There, he helped train Woody Harrelson and Antonio Banderas in the 1999 film Play It to the Bone. And in 2000, when Michael Mann needed someone to do the heavy lifting of turning Will Smith into Muhammad Ali, Darryl was Michael's top choice to carry that load. Darryl enters the room. 5'10", 190 pounds. Imagine if you could crossbreed a pit bull with a brick. The Omega symbol is branded proudly on his upper left arm. He's a Q-Dog, a member of the Omega Psi Phi fraternity. They're as hard as they come. His posture is rigid, straight up and down, head high, shoulders back, like a soldier, like a general. His hands, at their default setting, halfway to a fist, just in case. His presence is intense. He's already looking me up and down, unconvinced. He holds his hand out to greet me. Not a handshake, a closed fist. We pound. "How tall are you?" Darryl asks. I'm 6'2". "What you weighing right now?" I'm probably, 190. "Yeah, that's not enough," he says, almost to himself, making his way to the boxing ring. "Take your shoes off, hop up in here." What? I have jeans on and jewelry. I'm fly right now. But Darryl is already in the ring, waiting for me. Michael Mann is grabbing a video camera. Darryl slides the focus mitts on, and he claps them together, an explosion echoing through the cavernous warehouse. The reverberation seems to say, "Hurry the fuck up, bling boy." Darryl didn't give 2 shits that I was the biggest movie star in the world. In fact, he almost saw it as the biggest problem. Michael Mann helps me on with the 14-ounce gloves, and I step into the ring. This dude better not hit me. 90% of the people on earth is right-handed, Darryl said in a voice that seemed to be louder than necessary. That means if you're going to get knocked out in the street, most of the time it's going to be with a looping overhand right. In order to deliver that punch, a person's right foot got to be set back. That's how he going to get the leverage to throw it. You see that shit in the street all the time when niggas is beefing. So when you see them shift their weight, you know what's coming. Your rear cranium bone is the hardest bone in your skull. So all we gonna practice today, put your left ear down to your shoulder and we gonna break their hand on top of your head. Then you gonna fire your right hand straight back. For about 30 minutes, we repeated that sequence. Darryl was pretending like we were in the street. He would talk shit, then shift his right foot back, throw the overhand right. I would time it so I caught the mitt on the back left section of my cranium, the hardest bone in my skull, and then I'd fire my right hand back at the center of his mitt. "You master that," Darryl said, "you're going to stretch most motherfuckers in the street." Is that a move that Ali did?" I said. "Don't you worry about Ali. I got to teach you how to fight first." Something about that promise rang deep within me. He was going to teach me how to fight for real. The thought of being able to physically defend myself induced reverence and surrender to Darryl's leadership. Michael and Darryl share a silent look. They've seen enough. Clearly, they need to talk about me behind my back. Daryl begins to remove the mitts and steps out of the ring.
Yeah, I'll see you tomorrow, Daryl says. Wait, what are we doing tomorrow? I say.
5 at 5. We only got a year. We need to get started. Daryl's style of training is full immersion. He doesn't ask anybody to do anything that he doesn't do. Over the next year, he ran every mile, jumped every rope, lifted every weight, sparred as many rounds, every moment of training right by my side. He ate when I ate. He slept when I slept. He worked when I worked. Often, he would quote Edgar Guest's poem, The Sermons We See. I'd rather see a sermon than to hear one any day. I'd rather one should walk with me than merely tell the way. The eye's a better pupil, more willing than the ear. Fine counsel is confusing, but example's always clear. This was not a dude that I thought was going to be quoting poetry. Daryl had a no actors rule. He set up an authentic fight camp. Every boxing role in the film would be cast with active professional fighters. Former heavyweight champ Michael Bent as Sonny Liston. James Lights Out Tony, a 3-weight class champ, as Joe Frazier. IBF cruiserweight champ Alfred Cole as Ernie Terrell. And 17-1 heavyweight contender Charles Shuford Jr. as George Foreman. These would be the anchor fights of the film.
We ain't doing no Hollywood bullshit around here. This a real fight camp, Daryl said.
We're preparing for a title shot. Fuck a movie. Everybody knew we were doing this for Muhammad Ali. Every fighter felt indebted and dedicated to the champ. There was an energy around the project that I had never experienced before. The purpose of the film had a unifying and electrifying effect on all of us. That first week was brutal. I had just finished a 30-minute footwork drill, and I was exhausted, so I laid down in the ring. Daryl saw me from across the gym and snapped.
Hey! Get the fuck up!
I stood up as he made his way over to the ring.
Do not get comfortable with your back on that canvas, he said. You fight how you train.
You fight how you train was one of Daryl's central axioms.
You do everything how you do one thing, he'd say.
Daryl didn't want me to get comfortable with my back on the canvas in case I ever got knocked down. He wanted lying down in a boxing ring to feel utterly foreign to me, just in case I ever found myself lying down in a boxing ring. His position was, dreams are built on discipline. Discipline is built on habits. Habits are built on training. And training takes place in every single second of every situation of your life. How you wash the dishes, how you drive a car, how you present a report at school or at work. You either do your best all the time or you don't. If the behavior has not been trained and practiced, then the switch will not be there when you need it. Training is for the purpose of habituating reactions to extreme circumstances, Daryl said. When situations get hot, you can't rely on your thinking mind. You must have habituated reflexive responses that kick in without the necessity for thought. Never detrain your killer instincts. The Sonny Liston and Joe Frazier fights feature early in the movie, so Michael Bent and James Tony were the first fighters I trained with. Daryl and I had spent the first 3 months with just the two of us, working on the fundamentals, footwork, posture, cardio, and developing the fluidity of the classic Ali jab, what Ali called the snake lick because it mimicked the strike of a cobra. Michael Mann brought in a brain scientist to help with what he called burning new neural passages, The scientists created a 20-minute loop of the quintessential Ali footwork and jab. I would sit in a pitch-black room watching the loop twice a day, staring at the repeated movement until it was seared on my brainstem. The first few months of training were in front of mirrors, in empty gyms, and in solitary locations. We ran at altitude in the snow in Colorado in combat boots. I could barely breathe. Daryl had run the same distance, but he looked like he had just awakened from a refreshing nap. I had to take a knee. Daryl didn't care much for my little break time in the snowbank. "Write his name," Daryl said. "What?" I said, struggling for a sip of oxygen. "Ali, write it." I leaned down and slowly began to write A-L-I. Daryl took out his phone and snapped a picture. "You need to remember why we suffering," he said, and began to run. When the group training camp began, it was no longer just Daryl and me. For the first time, I was gloved up across the ring from seasoned boxing champions. Daryl whispered to me as he laced up my gloves, "These are not actors. These are instinctual fighters. Their hands will just fly before they even know it. The first rule of boxing, protect yourself at all times." In the mirror, I was starting to look like Muhammad Ali. I was 223 pounds of muscle now, with a one rep max bench press of 365 pounds. But as soon as another fighter stepped in the ring, my fear wouldn't allow me to maintain my forward posture. I began leaning back at the waist too much. "Don't compromise your spine angle. Lean in," Daryl yells from outside the ring. "Just stay off the train tracks. Create angles." But Michael Bent was not inspiring me in the least to lean in toward him. I decided, fuck it, lean in. Just lean in. And my simple 2-inch spinal adjustment triggers Michael Bent's right hand. I see it coming, but it's too late. I only have enough time to put my chin down a little and brace for impact. Michael Bent's right hand lands high on my forehead. But because of my forward posture, my head doesn't snap back. Instead, it compresses down onto my spinal column. I feel an electrical shock shoot from the top of my spine down both arms, ending at my elbows. I have an alkaline, metallic taste in my mouth like I just licked a 9-volt battery. Fortunately, Bent sees that I'm hurt and doesn't follow with the left hook he hit Tommy Morrison with to become heavyweight champ. This was the first time I'd been truly hit. Every fighter in the room knew that this was a make or break moment. Fight or flight. Everybody went silent. Daryl calmly stepped up into the ring and sat me in the corner. "You good?" he said, knowing damn well I was not good. Michael Bent appeared over Daryl's shoulder. "Yo, you all right, God?" he said in his thick Brooklyn accent. All I could think was, where the fuck are my car keys? As I look back on my life, I see funny stories, beautiful experiences, tragic losses, magnificent victories, all held together by a handful of pivotal moments. Critical choices that completely altered the trajectory of my journey. In that ring with Michael Bent, a switch got flipped that would take a decade to get unflipped. The warrior within me took complete command of everything in my life. I stood up off the stool, looked at Bent, and said, "Good shot. Let's work." The 1 year of training and the 5 months of filming of Ali was the most grueling mental, physical, and emotional test of my entire career, but also the most transformative. The filming of Ali spanned 7 cities and 2 continents. We began in LA, did 2 weeks in Chicago, quick shoots in New York and Miami, and then it was time to bring it home. We were heading to the motherland. We were heading to Africa, a place I'd never been. The final sequence of Ali was shot in Mozambique. Michael Mann is a purist. He wanted to shoot in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where the actual Rumble in the Jungle took place, but the raging civil war there redirected the production to Maputo. Michael wanted the cast to feel what it was like to fly together and arrive together. Jamie Foxx, Jeffrey Wright, Nona Gay, Michael T. Williamson, Ron Silver, Mario Van Peebles, John Voight, and Michael Michelle, and me, JL, Charlie, and my whole squad. Michael was trying to orchestrate a similar emotional experience to the one that Ali and his crew had had. This was a part of his cinematic genius, and it worked. It is difficult to overestimate the power of a first experience in Africa. 2 steps off the airplane, and I'm already crying. I'm not sure if it was my cells or my soul that recognized their origin, but it was visceral and overwhelming. We found a quiet place just outside the airport in Maputo, Mozambique. We all huddled, held hands, knelt down, and kissed the ground. One of the airport workers yelled out from the other side of the fence, "Welcome home, brothers!" "Nelson Mandela has invited us to dinner," JL said in his regular-ass JL voice. I couldn't even respond. "His current wife is Graça Machel, the former First Lady of Mozambique," he said as though he was reading it from Wikipedia. "They have a house near here." "Jay, you got to start putting some expression on it when you tell me shit like that," I said. I had felt the world moving differently around this film. Ali's name alone opened doors in a way I'd never experienced. It engendered the goodwill of every person we approached. His legacy lubricated the logistical wheels of the production. Deal negotiations, permits, locations, casting, everything and everybody wanted to serve Ali. Whatever we needed to tell his story properly, the answer was always yes. It wasn't because of his fame or his boxing titles. It wasn't about success or money. The always positive reaction was about people's deep recognition and reverence for a life lived in integrity, in the face of grievous injustice, profound prejudice, and financial devastation. He never wavered from the convictions of his principles. He was the greatest fighter of all time, yet would always say, "My religion is love." Everybody wanted to be a part of honoring him. I had experienced the magnetism of fame. I knew well the allure of celebrity, the attraction of money. But this was my first dose of the power of purpose and the radiance of service. Nelson Mandela had spent 27 years unjustly imprisoned for opposing the South African apartheid regime. His eyes had been damaged from hard labor in the lime quarries. Upon the toppling of the apartheid system, he was released from Victor Verster Prison and was subsequently elected president of South Africa. One of his first official undertakings was the Truth and Reconciliation Commission hearings, where the architects and the perpetrators of the heinous system of racial segregation and brutality were put on trial. And in a controversial and extraordinary act, Nelson Mandela offered forgiveness and amnesty to those who would confess their atrocities. He was, however, widely criticized for this stance. But as he wrote in 2012, "In the end, Reconciliation is a spiritual process which requires more than just a legal framework. It has to happen in the hearts and minds of people. The night of the dinner came. 20 cast and crew members made our way to his suburban home in Maputo. As I entered, Charlie Mack and JL by my side, my eyes once again welled with tears.
"You don't need to cry, man," Charlie Mack said. "You belong here."
"Hello, Willie," Mr. Mandela said, joyfully bringing me into his arms. "Come, you will sit with me." Madiba, as he's known among his closest friends and family, grabbed my hand and walked me around his home. We must have held hands for a full 10 minutes. Men didn't hold hands like that where I grew up. The show of affection was overwhelming. I introduced him to everybody. He, in turn, introduced me to his wife, Gracia, and his family. He took his seat at the head of the dining table and sat me to his right hand. We all ate and talked and laughed, and he praised us for honoring Ali. Then, as the meal wound down, Madiba began to recount in vivid detail the horrors of apartheid and his 27 years in prison, 18 of them on Robben Island.
"As inmates, once a month we were shown a film, movies from all over the world. But American cinema was my particular favorite. There was a film called In the Heat of the Night, starring Sidney Poitier. In the middle of the movie, there was a strange glitch. I could tell that the film had been edited. I was so intrigued. I used all my angles and connections on the outside to determine what had been taken out. It took weeks, but finally I was informed that Sidney Poitier had slapped a white man in the face. Something in my spirit was energized. If black men in American cinema are standing on equal ground with their white counterparts, then it was only a matter of time. The film empowered me. It inspired me."
And then he paused. He looked directly into my eyes and said,
"Never underestimate the power of what you do."
After dinner, cast and crew are milling about. The evening is winding down. Madiba and I are sharing a quiet moment. He sits calmly, taken in the room. I catch myself staring. He has that same little smile and trance-like countenance that Gigi displayed every Sunday in Resurrection Baptist Church. The soft rise in the corners of his mouth betray an invincible serenity. My heart jumped at the recognition. He soon feels my gaze and turns his attention to me. I ask him, jokingly, but in all seriousness, "What's that look?" He peered into me, as if trying to discern whether I had accidentally asked a good question, or if I had asked in earnest, was I ready to hear the answer?
"If you will come and spend time with me," Madiba said, "I will show you."
"If you will come and spend time with me, I will show you." Madiba's words lingered as we prepared to film the final scenes of Ali, the rumble in the jungle, Ali versus Foreman. In a perfect example of art imitating life, this was the most difficult fight of Ali's career and also the most difficult fight to capture on film. The sequence took 2 weeks to shoot. Michael Mann had an entire stadium refurbished and over 20,000 extras in the stands. With the lights and the humidity, it was over 105 degrees in the ring, and I lost 11 pounds on the first day of shooting.
That meant I had to double the portions of chicken breast, broccoli, and brown rice I'd been enjoying for months. One weekend, everyone was sitting around in the house we had rented just outside Maputo. I had been training with Daryl and the other fighters for more than a year, and everything was coming down to this final sequence. The Africa experience was the culmination of the entire journey. My boys, Bilal Salam, Dave Haynes, and Mike Socio, flew in and brought a spark of new energy that I desperately needed at the time. But while everyone was thinking of this as a regular movie shoot, Daryl saw it as a fight camp. My boy Bilal ended up losing 100 pounds during the training and filming. Dave Haynes was my stand-in. In Hollywood terms, that means he would stand in the spots that I would eventually be so the crew could set the lights and the shots and get everything ready. Dave so impressed Michael Mann that Michael gave him the role of Ali's brother Rahman in the film. And I accidentally gave Dave a concussion during a sparring session. My boy Mike had been a writer on The Fresh Prince. I had hired him to video document our entire African experience. As far as he was concerned, he was here in a domestic capacity, and accordingly, he had had a case of Snickers shipped in from Philly. Daryl exploded. "Nigger, is you eating a fucking Snickers?" he said, which for Mike was confusing on two levels. One, in Mike's mind, he was just a videographer. And two, he's white. "Will is about to be in the ring with a 235-pound motherfucker punching at his head. This is the challenge of his lifetime. We all benefiting from his suffering, and you stuck in the fucking pleasure principle. He don't need to be seeing your ass chomping on no fucking candy bar. You either helping or you hurting. And if you're not committed to helping, then you need to take your ass the fuck home." Daryl and JL were perfectly in sync. JL knew the magnitude of this endeavor. He'd been fighting for that kind of order for years. Charlie's father had been a boxer. Charlie had been around boxing gyms his whole life. He understood the idea of supporting the champ to secure our collective win. Charlie and Dave even started calling me champ. Omar never trusted anybody anyway, so he loved that Daryl was defending the space. This fight camp, support the champ mentality became the new law of our group. Everybody had to run 5 at 5. Everybody had to work out in the gym. Everybody had to eat right. Everybody had to read and study and offer new ideas. Everybody had to live a disciplined life to reach for the best version of themselves. Otherwise, they had to go to fuck home. The unified mission of telling Muhammad Ali's story established a new fundamental way of being that would extend within our group far beyond the completion of Ali. The infrastructure in Mozambique was not equipped at the time to sustain a production the size of Ali. We literally had to rebuild and refurbish hotels and residences to accommodate cast and crew. Most of that crew and assets had to be brought in from neighboring South Africa. This created a subtle tension. A mostly white South African production contingent working for a mostly African American cast and crew, backed by a 100% black Mozambican support staff. The racial and nationalistic frictions were simmering from day one. But there was an immediate camaraderie between the African-American cast members and the Mozambicans. Jamie Foxx damn near became a local. He went out every night. Jeffrey Wright spent every free moment with artists and poets and musicians. He was always bringing somebody to set who had blown his mind. My barber, Pierce, ended up falling in love and getting married to a beautiful Mozambican girl named Eva. They have two gorgeous children, Madhu and Gael. We all took a liking to a young production assistant named George Maciel. He was in his early 20s and had one of those personalities that you never forget. Everybody liked him, which made him the de facto leader of the Mozambican PAs. George told us he wanted to move to the United States. We told him, sure, George, if you get there, we got you. 6 months after Ali rapped, George appeared in Los Angeles. He moved in with Pierce, and I financed a cleaning company that he owned and operated for 5 years until he felt he had gathered sufficient business knowledge to return and build in his native Mozambique. We financed the trucking company that he owns and operates to this day. The experience of Africa was spiritual, transformative, and deeply emotional for all of us. One day, George came to Charlie Mack and informed him that one of the white South African crew members had assaulted a young Mozambican PA. The South African crew member was responsible for cleaning and maintaining the bathrooms on set. Apparently, the Mozambican boy had allegedly left urine drops on the toilet seat. The crew member chased him down, grabbed him by the scruff of his neck, took him back to the bathroom, and allegedly wiped the toilet seat with his face. Charlie comes to my trailer in a rage.
Yo, come with me right now. Motherfuckers is tripping.